That's why we're having this conversation. Yeah. It's not just preemptive, but it's, I think, important to have these discussions as part of it. You can't just present these works in a vacuum anymore. Mm. We know too much.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a series of extraordinary talks. Talks that provide a new perspective on the one thing we love the most, classical music. World-famous conductor Alan Gilbert and me, German news anchor Michael Pavelitz, are talking about music. This episode is about one of the most famous American operas, which is also quite controversial, George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
There's some black singers who don't agree to sing Porgy.
We talk about our personal experiences with stereotypes.
My conducting teacher, he said, you're going to have to learn to use your hands very expressively because we know that you can't show expression with your face.
And we ask ourselves if and how an opera like Porgy and Bess should be performed today.
It is an artistic masterpiece. And I think it should be heard and it should be accepted in its flawed glory.
We are
Alan Gilbert
and Michael Pavelitz. And this is about music.
And life.
This time from the lobby of the small concert hall in the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg.
You know, this is the first time I've come in here from this direction. I always come from the other side, and it took me a moment to recognize where I was, although I've been in this space many times, but it's now transformed into a fancy studio.
I like the wood. And what do you like about this place?
Well, this is always where we have post-concert parties, so I like
so
it for
party,
that. I like it for that reason.
Yeah. How's the acoustic?
Here? Yeah. In the small hall? Yeah. You know, it's fine. I mean, I've done a few chamber music concerts and we can hear each other well. And we can hear something now, even.
Yeah.
The acoustics are...
What is it?
I don't know. You can name that tune.
It sounds like a...
It sounds like New Age elevator music.
Yeah, maybe like this. Or I think about a dentist. Dentist sitting in a dentist chair and calmed down by music like this.
Okay.
Being calmed down.
Is it that unpleasant to sit here talking to me? It makes you think of...
No, the music.
In the dentist chair. But it's. I was thinking maybe it's helpful to have something to calm you down. Speaking of calming down, I'm very excited to hear that you're going to a place that's very much in the news these days for your vacation, Finland.
Finland, yeah. I love this place. But the Russians are not amused. Finland wants to join the NATO.
I've been reading about this story with great interest because I live in Sweden.
In Sweden, yeah.
And just the idea that these countries are thinking of breaking away from their non-aligned status is
there tension in the country? Do people talk about it? Or?
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's a big topic. To kind of bring it around to what we're here to talk about, it's been very interesting the way the reaction has been in terms of the arts and dealing with musicians and expecting people to make statements against the regime and against Putin and
what do you think about this?
Well, I think that there are certain behaviors that I think are black and white, inexcusable. And support for that, I think, is unconscionable and wrong. And so I absolutely think that people like Gergiev, who, you know, it's sad to say, but I've known him for a long time and I've had sat down at a table with him for dinner many, many times. Mm-hmm. It's been tragic to see how he's been, I think, rightfully canceled.
Why would you say rightfully?
Because I think he's actively supporting Putin. I mean, he doesn't even hide it.
Valery Gergiev is a Russian conductor and opera director. In March 2022, he was dismissed as chief conductor of the Munich Philharmonic. The reason? He's a close friend of Vladimir Putin, and he openly supported the Russian president even after he started the war against Ukraine.
I think there are certain black and white cases. And, you know, I hate having to speak against someone that I kind of would have called a friend. Mm-hmm. I didn't know him well ever, but, you know, we were we were certainly on a first name basis. And,
but he's a great conductor, though.
He's a great conductor and a great artist, and has done things that have been infuriating. And you know, in retrospect, we probably should have been harder on him in the past when he stood up for the aggression in Crimea. I'm not here to talk about Valéry, but to expect other Russian musicians to come out and make statements against Putin, I think actually has been unfair and essentially has amounted to canceling musicians simply because they're Russian. Mm. And this idea that there's an absolute morality that people have to choose sides on is, I think, naive, and I think it's wrong. And it reminds me, and not just because I'm half Japanese, but it reminds me of the treatment of Japanese people, even citizens in the United States during World War II, who were put in prisons, essentially. They were, you know, holding camps, essentially, for people simply because they were Japanese during World War II. And just sort of guilt by association is a very harsh measure to take. And you see, you know, young musicians who wanted to do competitions, and competitions said, nope, we're not going to have any Russian musicians allowed. And to me, that seems completely misguided. I mean, wrong. Completely wrong. Yeah.
And on Instagram, I found a post of a young Russian cellist, maybe 18, 19, and she got canceled by a Swiss festival, really low-level local festival, because she's a Russian cellist. And she performed with a piano accompanist from Ukraine before, and they're friends. So I had to write an email, which I did, and this festival apologized 2-3 weeks later.
Yeah, there's this kind of knee-jerk reaction that makes people think, oh, well, some people will be offended, so we better avoid that. And it's so arbitrary to say that, okay, well, this person carries a Russian passport, therefore we can't have them because the Ukrainians in the audience are going to be offended. And maybe there's some, but I think most people don't have a problem with the people themselves. It's the ones who are responsible for the war and for the atrocities that are happening. They need to be held responsible. But to me, it seems like the young musicians are the ones we should be supporting, and not just young musicians, but young people, because my guess is that it only exacerbates the situation. It only like hardens these divisions by treating people differently, because there's no perfection in morality. And, you know, if you start holding people to a standard that essentially nobody can meet in terms of moral rectitude and saying the right thing at every minute in your life, it's just not going to work. And I have many Russian friends who are in the West, and who I know are horrified by what they see Putin doing, but feel, understandably, I think, terrified about speaking up because they have family still in the country, and they don't want people to be caught in some sort of collateral kind of revenge damage or something, which seems entirely possible, if not likely. So anyway, this is an interesting question.
You mentioned this experience of Japanese people in the United States during the Second World War, maybe after. You're half Japanese, your mother's Japanese. What was her experience? What did she tell you when she came to the States? Did it change then? I mean, this was New York, not California. Maybe there's a difference. I don't know.
Well, it's been interesting because over the years, we've kind of drawn my mother out a little bit and talked to her about it. And she said more in the last years than she did when we were growing up. She didn't refer to these things. And so I didn't know so much about her experience until relatively recently. And it's kind of amazing and very sad to hear about what she went through. My mom came to study violin at Juilliard with the famous Ivan Galamian at Juilliard when she was, I think, 18. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a charming story. My I think the biggest fear of my grandparents, her parents, was that she would, the way they put it, find a blue-eyed American and get married and not come back to Japan. So what happened? Exactly that. And anyway, they met, and my grandparents came over for what I guess was a very small wedding, essentially at a judge's apartment in New York, and they got married. And my dad said that he was quite intimidated because her Japanese parents came and they didn't speak a word to him, and they were just there very kind of impassive and watched the ceremony. Yeah. And then they went back to Japan, I guess, for the first time for my dad's some months later. And then they had another party there to celebrate with the Japanese family and the Japanese friends there. But my father said it was a fast, for him, that was the other way, because yeah. there weren't that many Americans in Japan at the time. And he said it was total culture shock, and mm-hmm. he would have to walk for like half an hour to get to the place that had the closest place that had an English language newspaper. Mm-hmm. And there were no signs in English. Of course, now if you go to Japan, it's easy because yeah. you know, everyone speaks English and there's signs in English. But at the time, nothing.
I've been there 4 or 5 years ago, and on the countryside.
Oh well, the countryside. That's
and nobody else. Spoke English.
Yeah, no, but that's different.
Everybody was really for us. Yeah, very friendly. And we made a tour in a museum yeah. with a Japanese guy, and he was really enthusiastic, explaining everything.
And you understood nothing.
No. yeah. But no, he was nice.
It's a very easy place to visit now, even if you don't understand anything, because you can. I think they are very welcoming for the most part. But anyway, this was my father's experience there. Mm. And then just to quickly wrap up this chapter of the story, after a few days, my grandfather invited my father out for beer. And they went out together and they got drunk together. And it turned out that he spoke perfect English.
Wow. Okay.
But he just had to get used to this idea. And yeah. after that, they were great friends yeah. for the rest of my grandfather's life. But my mother here, not here, in the States, yeah. Told me about experiences where she would call up a place to try to rent an apartment, because mm-hmm. my father was concertmaster of the San Antonio Symphony mm-hmm. in Texas, San yeah. Antonio, Texas. And the person on the other end of the phone would say, you have an accent. Where are you from? And my mom, I guess naively, would say, well, I'm from Japan. And the person would say, we don't rent to colored people. That was in the mid-60s.
I know this situation.
I know. And it's you know, so there was absolutely overt racism mm-hmm. that was going on against my mother at the time. And I guess it was different in New York, but I remember myself when I would walk down the street when I was a little kid in New York, and there was one time where there were kids, I guess they were having fun, but still they were kind of making fun of what they, I guess they thought I was Chinese, because for a lot of people, you know, Asian meant Chinese. I'm half Japanese, and they would, you know, kind of make fun of what they thought was this kind of caricature Chinese accent in English, and they were just like, so I was walking down the street. So, I mean, I've experienced that in you know, a small way myself, and it's not that long ago.
I know those moments trying to rent a flat. I must have been about 18, 19. But the guy was more elegant. He said, it's not because of me, it's the neighbors. You have to understand.
Yeah.
So they turned that way around.
Yeah, I mean, that's a convenient excuse that almost certainly masks a true racism in that person also, but it, you know, somehow gets them off the hook, they think.
Yeah.
But the difference is that there's some people who stand up for what's right and there's some people who don't. And so, you know, it's not enough to just say, oh, no, it's not me. I'm sorry.
Would you agree that you really learn to see what's behind it? Because I can smell racism, I think.
It's a very interesting question, because I know that I've experienced it, and you know, there's something that, have you been reading these, it's been very much in the news, sorry, wrong Asian?
No.
You know, it's like there's a guy, Jeff Yang, wrote an article, and he said, you know, he gets mistaken for Jeff Wang all the time, and it's very common. And mm-hmm. it's the same with the, you know, my conducting teacher at my first lesson, he said, well, you're going to have to learn to use your hands very expressively because we know that you can't show expression with your face.
Wow.
And that's connected to the idea that, oh, all Asians look alike. Or all black people look alike.
The moment you can remember your inner reaction?
Well, I was stunned. I mean, it was literally the first lesson. So I was already, it was the first lesson with an orchestra. Mm-hmm. So it was in public. It was in a public setting that this happened. And so I was very nervous and it was I didn't make anything of it because I was too sort of nonplussed to mm-hmm. react. But that kind of idea that, somehow you can write off an entire group of people and just say, oh, they all look alike.
Mm.
And that happens with any sort of ethnic group that people are not familiar yeah. with. It's not only against Asians, but it's very, very
did,
much.
Did you have, the idea to prove him wrong? And then.
Well, I mean, I ended up studying with him for 5 years.
Yeah.
And, it.
Did you bring it up later? No.
No. No. But I mean, it was one of those things that, I mean, I can give you many stories about that kind of thing, but it's
interesting. Yeah, so what is the pattern? What do you think about the stereotype for, what are some stereotypes for Asian looking people?
Well, you hear a lot of people say, oh, well, Asians, obviously they have really good techniques, but there's not a lot of expression. Mm-hmm. You hear that.
And just I remember.
No. Yeah. No, even today, I mean, there's this kind of assumption that it's only about accuracy and technique, yeah. which is, I know a lot of Asians who are not so expressive, and I know a lot of non-Asians who are not so expressive. So there's no monopoly on that. It's tricky. I mean, it's the experience as a black man, I'm sure, is different, and probably
It's different. And I can't. My experience was this conception that I'm driven by nature, not by decisions I decide. Not things I really decide, not by my brain. It's nature, it's impulse, instinct. And I remember a violin teacher at the university telling me, when a guy like you plays for an audition, Mozart or Beethoven, much more difficult for you, people will question if you're able to understand Beethoven. And then I remember playing for a guy at a Berlin university for music. Famous professor at that time. And he didn't listen. And then after a while he said, I know you from somewhere. I know you from... sorry for interrupting. I know you. Yeah, you played in the subway in New York. You were this jazz guy. You should do jazz. Jazz, that's your thing. Yeah, so this is these are my experiences.
Yeah.
I like jazz, by the way.
Yeah, nothing wrong with jazz, but it's that's.
How did this shape your way to how you do your job, how you understand your job?
Me personally,
yeah.
I honestly haven't thought so much about it. I've been lucky, I think, to be in situations where, for the most part, I think I've been accepted on my own merits or lack thereof. And I know that there's some sense of feeling that there's something to prove as an American musician. I think there's a subtle bias against American musicians in Europe.
What too. Kind of?
Just the assumption that like there's a kind of an American way of playing, kind of like loud and fast, and not understanding the kind of philosophy behind the music, mm-hmm. and And it's not prevalent, but you hear it sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And if American is used as an adjective about someone's style or playing, it's pejorative. It means something's okay. missing. It's like, oh, it's very American. And, you know, it's like oh, that's an American brass sound. It's like, what exactly do you mean? Oh, it's a little, you know, aggressive. And it's like, oh, okay, I see what you mean. And that's, you know, that exists. I mean, you hear people in Austria say, oh, well, only the Viennese can really understand Mozart.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, maybe, I guess. I always say that great music can withstand interpretation, mm-hmm. which is a kind of funny way to turn the phrase around, but you understand what I mean. And if it's great, then it actually can benefit from being approached in different ways. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that per se it's a liability to come at music in a different way. And mm-hmm. and one of the things that I've always tried to do, and this is a little bit my feisty, provocative side. I like to, like, you know, if I'm in France, I like to do French music. I don't shy away from it.
Yeah.
But when I started out, I was very often asked to do American music
okay.
in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, here comes an American doctor. Oh, here's our chance. We'll put some mm-hmm. Copland and Barber and Gershwin and Bernstein. And
because and, he can feel the syncopation.
Yeah, no, because, you know, he's American, so he should do American music.
Okay.
And, you know, we're not going to ask him to do Beethoven.
Yeah.
Is the sort of the unspoken thing, and I just resisted that. I never would mm-hmm. do that, so I didn't do American music almost at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make a point if I was going to a country to actually want to do the music from that country to, I guess, prove myself or to test it out or something. And the musicians that I've admired, some of the musicians I've admired, have actually been very adept at doing different styles of music. And you know, Leonard Bernstein was so good in so many different styles of music. And I mean, this is a very, very incomplete list, but Claudio Abbado could mm-hmm. do lots of different kinds of music brilliantly, or Herbert von Karajan, or you know, just Seiji Ozawa, or, you know,
You will do some American music. I brought some.
I've come around, and that's why we're doing this Porgy and Bess, which you're
No,
that
actually,
was a
I could,
brilliant we, segue. Did you plan that whole thing to get?
No.
What a professional!
We should listen to some of it. The most famous, because the music is great.
The most famous. How can you choose? Every number is the most famous. That's what's so miraculous about this piece. It's one hit after another. It's like The Marriage of Figaro. Every single number is just a classic.
Okay, that's fine.
Porgy and Bess is one of the most frequently performed operas in the United States. It was written by George Gershwin and had its Broadway premiere in 1935. The opera claims to depict the lives of black Americans set in the fictional settlement of Catfish Row in South Carolina. It is the love story of Porgy, a disabled beggar, and Bess, a former prostitute who struggles to turn away from drugs and her abusive ex-partner. George Gershwin decided that the piece should be performed only with black artists. This rule still applies today.
It's challenging with Porgy and Bess in a very direct way because you're supposed to do the piece with an all-black cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. What's your thought about that? It's like, you know, when you do Otello by Verdi, Otello is supposed to be a black man, and Desdemona is white, and that's kind of one of the cruxes of the story. But there have been great Otellos who are not black, and there are great Desdemonas who are not white. And traditionally, Otellos, if they were not black, would put on blackface, and then we start to get into very, very...
Yeah. My thoughts about the all-black cast is there were those human zoos that time. Hamburg was famous for it, at Hagenbeck's Tierpark. Black people from Hamburg that time, they had to take off their suits and to earn some money, they sat there half naked near to the zoo, a human zoo, to show a scene of an African family. And they got money for it. The white people came. Makes my skin crawl. And then they, you know, the zoo closed and they put their clothes on and lived in the town like normal people again. This all black cast idea reminds me to a human zoo.
You know, there's some black singers who don't agree to sing Porgy.
Yeah, we have one here. Where is he? Here. That's Harry Belafonte, and he said racially demeaning.
Porgy and Bess has always been controversial. Critics say it perpetuates degrading stereotypes about black people. For example, poverty, drug addiction, and violence. Harry Belafonte turned down an offer to star in the 1959 movie adaptation by calling the story racially demeaning. Other actors and singers avoided the opera so as not to be typecast. Although Porgy and Bess is supposed to be about the experiences of black people in America, it is in fact the work of an all-white team. In the 1950s, novelist James Baldwin described it as a white man's vision of Negro life.
I've had very interesting conversations about doing the piece at all. Mm-hmm. There's some people who feel it shouldn't be.
What are their points they try to make?
Well, there's this idea that it's not okay to culturally appropriate, and for this to have been this opera to have been written by a white Jewish guy, how could he possibly accurately reflect the black experience, because that's what it is. And it's actually not an attractive picture of the black experience. Yeah. It's a love story, but it paints a picture of drug abuse and rape, and the white characters are authority figures in the opera. It's distasteful, but there's something realistic about it, even though the language is highly stylized. It's written it's written out this kind of
black dialect. Gala accent, but it's fiction.
It's fiction. But it is a story that I think is universal. And it is what it is. It's flawed, and I think it's a launching pad for important discussions. Mm-hmm. And for me, the bottom line is that it is an artistic masterpiece, and I think it should be heard, and it should be accepted in its flawed glory. At the end of the day, Porgy is a sympathetic character, and there's something noble about him. He's misguided, and he's hopelessly naive. But he's kind of a hero at the end. And I think that is what you're left with, and this kind of optimism of you know, the very, very moving your spiritual that comes at the end is an optimistic, I think, positive moment of a vision for something that does not exist in the opera and that it will hopefully lead to.
But the Bess, the female main character.
She's bad news.
She's bad news, and
definitely
she has
bad
no.
News.
I think we don't know why she's acting.
Well, I mean, she's bad news, and I think she doesn't deserve to get a pass. Although she's also a drug addict, and as such, is not entirely in control of her decisions.
And this reminds me to the professor who told me I can't control Beethoven. Because those characters, for me, seem doomed to be like that. There is no enemy you fight against, like in a socialist drama or something. No, they seem to be drug addicts, criminals, by nature.
I actually think that the white characters are clearly responsible. And I feel a huge antagonism against the white people for creating this situation. To me, that actually is intrinsic in the story, that it's implied that the situation is a result of this deeply rooted racism. And to me, presenting the work can actually highlight that problem, mm-hmm. even though it is not a story about that. To me, the simple presentation of the story makes it abundantly clear what the fundamental societal issues are. I don't know if I disagree with you, but I mm-hmm. I think it's possible to present the piece and make it very clear, the agency
what
and the responsibility.
To make this clear?
I think the way that it has to, it's a question of how the piece is presented. I mean, we've mm-hmm. talked about, you know, some directors have said, oh, well, we should take out the white characters because mm-hmm. it's so cringy. And I actually have argued, well, it's for that very reason that we shouldn't take them out. Mm-hmm. It is cringy. Let's just suck it up and accept it. It's not okay. And it can be a teachable moment, as they say.
Music and moral aspects. We don't talk about Wagner right now. We don't. No. Yeah. Do we? Because he's a. This is. He's genius too, in a way. And do you have the same problems performing Wagner when, like, performing Porgy and Bess?
It's. Yeah. Yeah, worse in a way, because the story is it's the question is always, can you separate the human being from the artistic product? Mm-hmm. And the answer is obviously no. If you have to answer a yes or no, in a yes or no way, Wagner also spent an incredible amount of time writing political screeds and manifestos. I mean, if you look at the collected writings of Wagner, you just wonder how he had time to do it all, because he just wrote thousands and thousands of incoherent, rambling pages about race theory. Yeah. And I mean, he was an abhorrent person.
And the most famous is Das Judentum, über das Judentum in der Musik.
Oh. Yeah, just crazy. And it seems clear that a character like Alberich and, you know, those characters are Jewish caricatures. And
do you think it's okay to cancel those pieces?
I think you should absolutely not cancel works of art because they contain flawed elements of human nature and human behavior in the past. It would be too difficult. I mean, it's not that it's too difficult. It's that there's no end to where you would have to what you would have to start canceling. If you say, "Oh, look at this book. There's a black servant that appears. I mean, Rosenkavalier. There's that famous last scene where the little, you know, it's supposed to be a little black kid who comes out and picks up the handkerchief and runs off. You know, it's uncomfortable." Mm-hmm. But it's in the piece. Or if you look at any work, you know, Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, you know, a literary masterpiece based on the time in which it was written. And if you say, okay, well, there's obviously a power imbalance between the two main characters, you know, Jim and Huck, therefore we shouldn't read it. I mean, if you start canceling everything, then, like, the human record will be pretty much expunged. And
is there a way in between? What do you think?
I think the important thing is to be honest and to keep your eyes open and to actually have real discussions, mm-hmm. like I think what we're trying to do now, for example. There's you know, the course through human history is an ongoing journey, but I think it's important to keep the record, mm-hmm. And admit that things have not been perfect and say that things still need to improve, but canceling everything that has the slightest hint of a racist tendency would start to cancel kind of an incredible amount of great art.
Which raises the question, who decides what has racist tendencies and how much? Who decides?
I'm not sure what you mean.
The people who build the programs?
Well, I mean, people are, if you're reading novels, people read with differing degrees of insight.
Mm-hmm.
And some people see racism for what it is, and some people miss it. I don't think you can say that, okay, you have to be this good at reading in order to be able to teach a course on American literature. You hope for the best teachers possible, and it fundamentally becomes an educational question or a question of education. And the more people are equipped with good background and good grounding in the subject of, you know, ethics and history. That's why I'm happy that my daughter's planning to go to a liberal arts college in the States. She wants to be a musician, and I think it's really good because these very real discussions happen at the good schools. It's an oversimplification, but lack of education and lack of access to education and lack of interest in education is, I think, as responsible for the problems of the world as almost anything else. The access to critical thinking and the idea that, you know, the principles of the Age of Enlightenment are important, you know, that's being really shunted to the side now. And you know, even as musicians and as journalists, I think, you know, we benefit from having the widest possible exposure to the evolution of human thought, not just human thought, but the evolution of human thought.
Do you see it as evolution, that those steps we take right now are steps of really a bigger way we are going?
It goes, but it goes, yes
and no. Direction? One
no,
direction?
Absolutely not, unfortunately. It's the thing, you know, it's like Sisyphus, you know.
Yeah.
You keep getting pushed back.
Yeah.
And maybe hopefully it's two steps forward and one step back. Sometimes it feels like one step forward and 25 steps back.
Yeah.
But the hope is obviously that there are enough people who are still trying to walk in the right direction that the general trend will continue in the right way. Maybe doing a piece like Porgy and Bess can help.
Let's hope so.
I have no illusions about, you know, it's like we don't solve problems by doing art, but if we can give a spot of hope and optimism and idealism, that's at least a small part of what motivates us.
Mm. Are you ready for people complaining about you doing this Porgy and Bess?
Absolutely. That's why we're having this conversation. Yeah. It's not just preemptive, but it's, I think, important to have these discussions as part of it. You can't just present these works in a vacuum anymore. Mm. We know too much. You know, maybe 50 years ago or 20, even 20 years ago, you could get away with it. If you look at old movies, you know, even from 20, 30 years ago, you think, really, was that acceptable then?
Yeah.
And it was.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Because but now we know more, so we don't get that pass.
Mm.
And that in its small way, I think, is also a sign of progress.
Yeah, totally agree. Alan, thank you so much.
It's it's more than a pleasure. It's really interesting. And next time I'm going to only talk about your job.
Okay.
I want to hear about what you do. And specifically about presenting the news and having to be somehow neutral when you're presenting things that obviously have very clear sides. It's very interesting to me.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, no, but that's
it's hard.
Your turn next time,
yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for watching and listening. This is about music, and this is about to go on. So watch out for the next episode.